Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and if you've been listening to the show every week, you know I investigate the leading edge of spiritual realities that are coming into the country, into the planet, and how that's transforming our belief system and opening us up to more of who we are. So tonight's guest is very much devoted to that understanding of our expansion. He's the Grand Master of the North American International Gnostic Templars, and we'll be talking about the ancient tradition of the Templars. His name is Mark Amaru Pinkram, and he's going to be coming to New York this week to give a lecture at the Meta Center on Thursday night. So for more information about that, I'll announce that after the show, or at the end of the show. Mark, are you there?
Yes, hello, Alan.
You know, there's a lot of talk about the Templars, and there's a lot of uncertain history, and there's been lots of books out, and going back to Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Can you tell us who the Templars were from, you know, and what their spiritual philosophies were?
Well, sure, Alan. Actually, our organization is devoted to bringing forth the truth behind the Templars, which is timely. Everyone seems to be interested in them now, thanks to Dan Brown, the Da Vinci Code, and so forth. People know that there's something unique about them. There are some secrets, and that's what we're dedicated to bringing out into the public eye right now, because we believe it's time. See, the truth of the matter is that the Templars, from the very beginning, were a Gnostic organization. They were dedicated to mystical experience. According to the esoteric history, our first Grand Master, Theuda Paons, was initiated into a lineage known as the Johannite lineage. And the Johannite lineage had originated with John the Baptist, and he was the first Western Grand Master of it. He passed the lineage to Jesus. Jesus passed it to the two beloved disciples at the foot of the cross, Mary Magdalene and John the Apostle. And from that point on, it passed down a lineage of Grand Masters, all who have named John, because John was really not a name. It was a title. It meant he of Gnostic power and wisdom.
And, is that what John meant? I never knew. Is that why John is so common a name as well? Because
If you go back into the Bible, into the Gospels, you find that the angel Gabriel appeared to John's mother Elizabeth and said, "Look, you've got to name this child John, because John wasn't just a name; it was a title." John the Baptist was born full of Gnostic wisdom and power, so he had to be called John. That's what he was.
But so what I know of Gnostic wisdom, it's a kind of innate knowing, a gnosis. I mean, it comes from the Greek word to know. And so there's a kind of direct knowing of the divine with oneself that bypasses religion. But then there's Christian Gnostics. But my understanding is that it's of Gnosis is that it predates Christianity as well.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, Alan. The truth of the matter is this Johannite lineage that I'm referring to now began in the East. It began thousands of years before Christianity. The Mandean people that John the Baptist, he was part of the Mandean culture, they claim that they originated on Sri Lanka, and to them, that was the Garden of Eden. And Mandean means Gnostics. They came west. They merged with the Persians, the Sumerians, Egyptians. Finally, they merged with the Essenes, and they formed a sect known as the Nazarenes or the Nazarenes. And this is
the Nazarenes
called the Nazarene.
That predates Jesus, the Nazarenes?
Many thousands of years, yeah. Because
and they were
the great masters.
Yeah.
The great masters of the Mandaeans were known as the Nasarai, and they formed the Nasarenes. Nasarai means the people of the serpent, the serpent power and the serpent wisdom. You see, in the ancient times, the serpent power and serpent wisdom was associated with Gnosis. The serpent was a lucky symbol, and it symbolized Gnostic wisdom and power. It was
well, even in the Greek tradition, I guess there was a merging of the Greek and the Hebraic cultures, well, before the Romans, but as the Romans and the whole Hellenization of the Middle East, there was a merging of the mystery schools that were part of the Delphonic Oracle.
Well, actually, you're right, but the Gnostic sects that formed in Alexandria that we're familiar with, the Ophites, the serpent worshippers, and so forth, they actually started with John the Baptist. He started that whole tradition, that whole Gnostic tradition in the West. He had a number of disciples. He had John the Baptist. He had Jesus. He also had Simon Magus, who was one of the first founders of Gnosis in the West. And he had many disciples all up and down the Asia Minor, close into Alexandria and into Egypt.
Who influenced John the Baptist? Where did he create these ideas from?
Well, John came out of the Mandaean tradition. The Mandaeans today, they still exist in southern Iraq, and they will tell you that John was not a Jew. He was Mandaean. All right? Because, the center focus of their spiritual rites is the baptismal rite. All the baptism that John was doing came out of the Mandaean tradition.
But the baptism rites were also what they call in the Jewish tradition the mikvahs, the holy bath, the purification. I mean, that's still popular in Orthodox Judaism. So I thought baptism came out of that. Yeah.
But the Mandaeans knew it a little bit different, because in the Mandaean tradition, a baptism was not with the physical water. Even though you're immersed in the physical water, it was actually the energy flowing through the physical water that baptized you. And they call this the water of life. They call this the Holy Spirit. It's known as Kundalini in the East. This is how John was initiating people. He wasn't just cleansing them. He was actually initiating them.
So he was able to awaken people's Kundalini, like Jesus could only do what he did because his Kundalini was awakened.
Now, absolutely.
So how does this all fit into what you're doing now, and what are some of the belief systems and practices of this International Gnostic Templar Association?
Well, to complete what I was saying a minute ago, when the Templars were formed, our first Grand Master, Eutychians, became the Grand Master of this Johannite lineage. So from that point on, this very, very ancient tradition of Gnostics became synonymous with the Templars. It was part of us. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that we took the rites of that tradition into Europe. And of course, at that point, the Catholic Church heard about it, and they were heretical. Anything that wasn't Catholic was heretical, and they infiltrated our preceptories, and that was the end of that. They saw that we were involved with heretical rites, and they brought us down, and burned us at the stake and so forth. But we survived, and a lot of us went up to Scotland, and that's where we continued.
The Roslyn Chapel, the whole
exactly right.
The Scottish rites. You're saying the Scottish temple? Yeah.
Well, the St. Clairs were very much connected to the whole Templar tradition. It said that Catherine de St. Clair, one of the earliest St. Clairs, married Hugh de Payens, and so this basically the destinies of the St. Clairs and the Templars were intertwined. And in our tradition, our International Order of Gnostic Templars is connected to the St. Clair line. The St. Clairs are always connected to the Gnostic tradition of the Templars, and that's what you find at Roslyn Chapel. All those images inside and outside of Roslyn Chapel are Gnostic images that were passed to the St. Clairs directly from the Templars, and in the crypt underneath Roslyn Chapel are ancient scrolls and documents that the Templars received, these Gnostic scrolls and documents that the Templars received. They exist in Roslyn Chapel in the crypt. And these are totally heretical documents. They talk about this long lineage through John the Baptist from the East. They talk about Jesus as being just one of many sons of God in this lineage. They talk about the true successor of Jesus as being John the Apostle, Mary Magdalene, not Saint Peter. So if these ever come to light, which we hope they will, and we're working to make that happen, well, it's going to blow the roof off of the Catholic Church if it hadn't happened already, which, you know, it seems like that could happen any time now anyway.
Well, what exactly are you hoping to happen to blow the roof off the Catholic Church?
Well, we want these documents to come to light.
And what are in the document? Yeah.
There was a document that floated around a number of years called Leviticon, and it said in that document that the true successor of Jesus was John the Apostle, but the Catholic Church played it down because they said, well, there's no true documentation about this, right? They, you know, that all the documents of the Leviticon that exist, they're all spurious. But these documents that are in Roslyn Chapel in the crypt, they are authentic documents that go back to the 12th century of the Templars. And so when they come to light, the church cannot just, you know, ignore them, because they are authentic documents, and they talk about what I just mentioned, you know, this long Gnostic lineage from the East that Jesus and John the Baptist were part of.
But what's the belief, what's the core belief? What would you like people, if these documents came out, how would you like people to be? What would their belief system, how would they transform, and what would you see as the ultimate religion in a way?
Well, okay, you see, the whole Gnostic tradition came out of the goddess tradition. The goddess tradition is all about going out and having your own experience and finding God within yourself. It's totally different from the God tradition, the fundamentalist religions, where God is someplace else. He's up in a heaven realm. But in the Gnostic tradition, he's right inside your own heart, or she or he or whatever you want to call it, is right inside your own heart. And so what we are trying to do is we are trying to bring back the original spiritual tradition. The original spiritual tradition was the Gnostic tradition that started on Lemuria with these original sons of God. They brought it from other realms and dimensions, and they had their first schools on the Garden of Eden on Lemuria, and the Mandean brought a lot of that wisdom west with them and incorporated into the Nazarene sect of John the Baptist and Jesus. And so what we are trying to do is bring back the original tradition, the original Gnostic tradition. We want to make Gnosis a household word now, a household name, because we believe that now is the time for us to take God from the heavens and place him right inside our own hearts so we can truly know who we are. And this is what the secret societies have been working for hundreds of years. Ever since the Templars, that goal, that agenda of creating a one-world Gnostic society was passed to all the secret societies of Europe, the Freemasons, Rosicrucians, Illuminati. They were all Gnostics and alchemists. You see, the alchemy is kind of the flip side of Gnosis. It's through alchemy that we evolve ourselves enough so that we can tap into that Gnostic awareness within our own hearts. And so this is the original path, the original tradition. And in fact, all religions started with some Gnostic tapping into that Gnostic awareness, coming back, sharing it with his disciples, and they turned around and make a religion out of it.
Right.
Starts that way, and it ultimately ends that way. So that is the primal path, and that's what links all religions around the world. That's what how they all started, and that's what all links them together. And this is what we are trying to bring back to the world, so that we can truly, as a planetary humanity, move or accomplish our evolution here, which is to know ourselves as God, Goddess, incarnate in a physical body. We cannot do it in the fundamentalist sects, because they all say God is someplace else. You can never say God is within your own heart. That's totally heretical, right?
Right. So, no, and I think, yeah, go ahead. No, but I just want to say the Goddess tradition seems to be coming back in many forms and around the world. I mean, it's never left places like India, the white buffalo, the return of the white buffalo calf woman. These are all forms of the goddess that seem to be re-emerging at this time. And
well, that's right. And a lot of how that's happening is through the Tantra tradition of India. And the Tantra tradition is the latter-day manifestation of the ancient Lemurian tradition. So the Lemurian tradition, on Lemuria was this primeval goddess culture where the goal of Gnosis was espoused. That was the goal for everybody on Lemuria. And that tradition was passed to India, the Gnostic tradition. That's where we get a lot of the tantric tradition. That's where we get a lot of tantric sex is coming around, a lot of tantric rituals directly from India, you see. So it's this really this ancient Lemurian tradition that is coming, being reawakened and revived now, you see.
Yeah, because it's about, I mean, it's about being in the physical body and the goddess. I mean, in my understanding, this earth, these bodies are an aspect of the goddess herself. And I know in your book, I came across your book, Conversations with the Goddess, where you had a very direct experience of a contact with these, one of these goddess type figures. Do you want to talk about that and what you learned from that experience?
I've been connected to the goddess for a long time. When I wrote that book, a lot of it was based on some conversations I had up in the mountains in Washington State where the goddess just started talking to me, and she told me the whole history of her tradition. And it was just like, it was amazing, like the floodgates opened up of wisdom and knowledge, and it all came pouring through. Well, soon after that, I was told by her that I needed to become a Templar, and I needed to revive the ancient Gnostic rites of the Templars. And one reason I needed to do that is because the Templars is kind of a rallying point for all the Western mystery traditions. You see, so many of them feel connected to the Templars, the Rosicrucians, the Illuminati, the Freemasons. They feel connected to the Templars, so it's a rallying point. We all have that in common. And through the Gnostic Templars, we can all come together and revive this Gnostic tradition. The goddess saying now is the time. You see, now is the time to revive this. So she's constantly guiding me and telling me what my next step is. She's showing me, you know, how I had existed on Lemuria, how I'd been a priest king. She told me to come here to Sedona. She showed me all the temples. This was once a Lemurian civilization here, and she's guiding me step by step, showing me what I need to do. She guided me to Ian Sinclair, because the Sinclairs were always connected to the Gnostic tradition of the Templars. So what, bit by bit, she's guiding me, and right now she's saying it's time to rally together the peoples around the earth that are ready to move into this Gnostic awareness, that are ready to go beyond the fundamentalist duality and into oneness again.
But if we know the God is within, if we have that gnosis, that knowing, then what are the rites? What are the Templar rites about? If we already have that understanding, how do they facilitate that? The rites that you
perform. Well, it's
perform?
Just through alchemy. I mean, see, all the secret societies, all the members of the secret societies, they were all alchemists. And
but what kind of things do you do? Yeah.
Well, there are certain. Well, we do both inner and outer alchemy. Inner alchemy is more on the guidelines of yoga. You know, a lot of breathing, a lot of postures, a lot of moving of the kundalini energies through yoga. But we also work on creating elixirs that can be taken internally that will actually also work to awaken that kundalini energy. So there's a number of things we're doing. We're also doing a lot of work here, right here in Sedona, which traditionally throughout time has been a headquarters of Gnosis, because of the red rock here. It works as kind of a kundalini activator, just being here, because it creates this incredible electromagnetic field that if you're just within that field, you can have a spontaneous activation of your kundalini, and which is important, because in order to be completely established in Gnosis, your body has to go through some alchemical transformation. Certainly, you can have experiences of Gnosis. You can someday wake up and realize that, you know, the whole universe exists within your own heart, that you are God, goddess, you created this universe. You can have that experience, but to have it ongoingly, continuously, your body has to go through the work of alchemically transforming itself and opening up those Gnostic centers permanently. And so that's what we try to do here in Sedona, help people to arrive at that permanent awareness.
So we have Gnostic centers in our bodies, not the chakras. Are you already talking about the chakra system?
No, I'm definitely talking about the chakras, yeah. And the primary ones associated with Gnosis is the heart, where the spirit exists, and the third eye. Those are the two ones we especially work with. And of course, the root chakra, where exists the kundalini energy that rises up and opens up those two centers.
So what kind of rituals actually or things would people actually do to help open up those centers? I mean,
Well, we have, when I teach the workshop, when I teach the seminar this Sunday, I'm going to be teaching everybody a certain activation exercise that they can do all the time for awakening those specific three centers. And besides that, I'm going to be giving them information about other things that they can do as well. There's many, many different kinds of Gnostic practices, alchemical practices that one can adopt in order to awaken the Gnostic centers. And this is what they do in India. You see, this is why there's all these different kinds of yogas, because there's so many different temperaments out there. And what works for one person is not going to work for somebody else. So we have a lot of different things that we give people that they can pick and choose from, what seems right for them and their lifestyle.
So when you opened up these centers in yourself, what changed in your experience of the world? How did that differ?
Well, I think that one of the main things is that the guidance is always there. I don't have to deliberate so much. I don't have to vacillate back and forth. Should I do this? Should I do this? What about this? The intuition is active enough in my connection to the goddess, so, or in my own spirit, so I know what to do. There's just like this huge aha that just reverberates throughout my whole body, and there's no question. And so the doubt disappears about what my life is about, and the confusion about what am I here to do? Why am I here? And besides that, there, you know, occasionally there is that sense of who and what I am truly in spirit. But I'm still on the path too. I haven't arrived at that place where I have that ongoing revelation within myself. You know, I'm still a seeker myself. I'm still on that path.
And what will it be like, do you imagine, if you arrive at a place? How will your reality be experienced differently?
Well, I've studied with masters in the East, in India, and what they say at that point is that they have no personal desire. You know, any personal desire is just been kind of melted away, and they say they don't have a whole lot of ego. They say their ego is like a burnt seed. It can't take root in anything. The ego can't say I'm this or that anymore. And they say that the mind stops. They say that the subjective mind, the subjective mind, not the intellect, but the subjective mind, the mind that keeps telling you how life is, how you are, what the world is about, that completely stops.
The critic, mind. Yeah.
What you become is simply the witness. You merge into what they call witness consciousness, or the Turiya state, they call it, where you're just witnessing it all. You're not getting caught up in anything. I mean, you can get caught up if you want, but you always have the option not to, which is not the case for a normal human being. And they also say that the masters say that they don't do anything unless they feel the inspiration coming from within them. They know it's their own spirit, their higher self that's guiding them, and they won't get out of bed in the morning unless they feel that inspiration that just, you know, reverberates throughout their whole body. Then they know that they are guided to do something.
So did you start this order of Grand North American Prion International Gnostic Templars? Was this something you founded, or was this something that was a lineage that was passed on to you?
Well, I got together with Ian Sinclair. Ian Sinclair had been part of Maliti Templi Scotia, which was the main temple organization in Scotland at the time, and that kind of dissolved. And the bigwigs, the head honchos of the organization, including Ian, went off and created their own temple organizations at that point. And it was at that point that I got together with Ian, and together we decided that, you know, it was time. We felt the inspiration, the calling, in order to revive the Gnostic alchemical practices of the Templars. And as I said, the Sinclairs have always been involved with the Gnostic rites and doctrines and understandings, and so it wasn't foreign. It was kind of a natural step, a natural thing to occur. And I have quite a deep background, extensive background in Gnosis, because having lived in India and been involved with the Gnostic path since I was 20 years old, and of course Ian has a tremendous background in the Templars and the Templar Rite, so we came together and we merged the two together, and so we have the International Order of Gnostic Templars.
But where did the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons, where, because, you know, Freemasonry has, like, gotten, you know, very popular and fashionable, and where does that fit into the whole Templar understanding?
Well, so many of the rites and rituals of Freemasonry came directly from the Templars. We take the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. The 18th, 17th and 18th degrees are Gnostic degrees, Gnostic practices, Gnostic rites that came directly from the Templars. The Templars themselves went through that initiation.
Yeah, but the Freemasons, the goals that they want are completely different from what you're laying out as,
Well, that's exactly right, because they've lost the mystical focus, the mystical emphasis of their organization. And we get a lot of Freemasons that come around today that are very interested in our organization. They're tired of just going through these mindless, hollow rituals, not even understanding what they're about, and they want more. They want the deeper mystical experience, you know. But to tell you something more about that is that when the Templars escaped France in 1307, they went up to Scotland, and King Robert the Bruce, at the time, he had been excommunicated, so the Templars didn't need to worry about the Inquisition up in Scotland. And when the Templars arrived up there, King Robert the Bruce actually formed the Royal Order of Herodom, which was a Freemasonic organization, and that was going to be the Templar organization in Scotland. And so, mm-hmm. so the Templars basically became the Royal Order of Herodom, and the Royal Order of Herodom became the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. So this is how it went. So basically, the Templars became the Freemasons from one perspective.
But there's so much, it seems to be so much more. I mean, you're laying it out very simply, but I mean, I'm sure it is simple on one level, but there's so much mystery, and I think there's secrets that the Templars knew of manifestation, of inner worlds, of all these things that the church wanted to suppress, and other people that are still secret. And can you reveal some of these secrets? Because I think, you know, there's esoteric knowledge that needs to come out in the public that we have not yet heard. Do you know what I'm talking
about?
Well,
I think that, the biggest secret or the biggest mysteries are the alchemy and the Gnosis. The church, of course, has always been trying to destroy the Gnostics and the alchemists, because it's through that path, the Gnostic alchemical path, that one can open up their Gnostic centers and receive guidance and information directly. They can know it directly without the priest or minister telling them how it is. And so why do we need the church if we can do that? Well, the church was created by the Roman Empire to control our mind and thinking. And so, you know, church can't have us, getting our own answers within. Also the Holy Grail lineage.
What is that about? Yeah, what's the Holy Grail?
See, they talk about the Holy Grail as being this or that. Most recently, it's the body of Mary Magdalene. Well, the truth of the matter is, there's many, many, there's countless Holy Grails. I mean, if you read the Holy Grail legends that were written in the 14th centuries by Templars, they talk about many Holy Grails. They talk about the cup of Christ, but they also talk about the Holy Grail as being a rock, as being a book.
But what does it mean? What is the Holy Grail? What's it do? What's it do for people, the Holy Grail?
Well, then, what all these Holy Grail manifestations have in common is that if you touch one, if you're around one, the energy, the frequency of that object enters you and initiates that process of alchemical unfoldment. That energy they possess is high frequency, Holy Spirit, Kundalini, whatever you want to call it. They're saturated with that energy. And, like you take, for example, the Articles of the Passion, the Crown of Thorns, the cross itself, the Veil of Veronica, the Holy Shroud, all of these have been ascribed the powers of a Holy Grail. Why? Because they were saturated with the energy of Jesus. And Jesus was a Holy Grail Master.
Would you say on some level it's making love to the Divine Feminine? embracing the Holy Grail?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Holy Grail is, I mean, it is the archetypal form of the goddess, the chalice, and mm-hmm. but it also has her energy, the Holy Spirit energy, the Shekinah, the Kundalini, whatever you want to call it, the Shakti. That's her energy that makes something a Holy Grail, right?
I mean, what?
And,
yeah.
So the true Holy Grail for the Templars, for the highest Templars, they knew the true Holy Grail was the power that's passed from one grandmaster to the next, and is the power that a new Templar initiate receives when he goes through his first initiation.
And you do that for people. You pass that Shakti, that power, to people, don't you?
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's part of the Gnostic path of the Templars and the Gnostic mm-hmm. rites of the Templars. And these heretical actions that the Templars were accused of, they were true. You know, what were they?
What were the heretical? Name some of those. Yeah.
Well, some of them had to do with the initiation of a new Templar. That oftentimes he would be asked to disrobe and take off all his clothes, and then the initiation would ensue, where the initiating Templar would kiss the new initiate below the navel at the base of the spine. Now these are two points that are directly associated with Kundalini in the body.
The male head of the order would kiss the new initiate there to activate the Kundalini, not as any sexual or personal act.
No, it wasn't anything sexual. And then it was also the transmission through the breath of the initiating Templar. He transmitted his power to the new initiated by the Templar kiss. He kissed him on the mouth and transmitted his energy that way. Now these are common rites of initiation that are still practiced in the East. They were practiced by the Sufis, for example, and I believe that this is where the Templars learned a lot of these initiation practices. It was directly from the Sufis, but you can still find this initiation transmission in this same way happening in the East today.
But the head of the order has to have the power in order to pass it. I mean, they have to have it embodied.
Well, that's right. Every Templar, every Grandmaster Templar was a John of the order. He was part of that lineage from the Far East. And if he was a John, well, then he was full of the Gnostic power and wisdom. So the power passed from one Templar Grandmaster to the next. And that was truly their secret, that power that they possessed, that was passed to them, but also they continued to generate it through their alchemical experiments, outer alchemy and inner alchemy.
But it also does have to do with sexual energy as well, because that's the base of
It is sexual energy. It's the same sexual fluids that move out of you in the sexual act that get transmitted into Kundalini energy and then rise up. The Kundalini feeds off those sexual fluids.
So are there sexual practices that the Templars would engage in?
That could have been. I mean, it was certainly part of the Gnostic tradition that there was sexual practices that were used between two members, two people, two partners, in order to awaken that energy. I mean, Aleister Crowley was infamous for his sexual escapades. He said that a lot of his sexual rites came directly from the Templars.
And it's also the tantric tradition, which is really an alchemical tradition of mixing
Johannite tradition that the Templars inherited came from the Far East. It was part of the tantric tradition that came from the Far East,
And you talk about Johns. It's just interesting, prostitutes call their clients Johns, and it just got, the whole thing got really distorted when I guess the church came in and kind of exposed the Templars as some subversive, perverse cult. The whole thing got really distorted, and people demonized the Templars in a way, didn't they?
Well, they did, and that's because they didn't understand the Templars.
Of course.
And when the Inquisition stormed the Templar preceptories over some of the main altars, they found this big hulking picture of Baphomet, which I took one look at that, and I said, oh, well, we found what we're looking for. There's the devil right there in front of us. Well, see, the Templars understood it in a different way. They understood it from the Gnostic perspective, and that is that the Baphomet that looks like the devil is actually a personification of the Kundalini itself.
Is that why? I never understood that part of all these books I'm reading where they call it the Baphomet, this devil.
That's right, yeah. The Baphomet, simply, it's actually, you could say it's a name for the Kundalini itself. So they named the head of John Baphomet because John's head was full of Kundalini. Well, the goat of Mendes that they made into the Baphomet, they also called it Baphomet because the goat of Mendes, the way they created him, he's an androgynous figure. And that's what the Kundalini is. It's an energy that unites the male and female together. You see, that's what all alchemy is about. All alchemical experiments are all about uniting male and female principles together in one to create that alchemical elixir or that alchemical force. So that's all alchemy is. I mean, this is what we're going to be, what I teach in the seminar is truly what alchemy is and what Gnosis is, because now is the time that people need to start really waking up to what this is all about and start integrating it into their lives. Now is the time, you know.
Well, how do you teach the alchemy? What practices or what you, we said elixirs, what do you actually do in the course?
Well, as I said, there's one technique that I teach, and I'll teach it over and over again to make sure that people can grasp it. Also teach some about creating your own elixir, your own outer elixir that you can take daily for both longevity and for ultimately immortality.
What's the ingredients in the elixir, if you don't mind sharing them, or something? Where's it?
Well, we talk about the white powder gold and using that. I mean, we talk about other ingredients, but that is definitely one that we.
Oh, I see. So, in the course, you're going to teach people how to make their elixirs?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And who has
something that can? Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just wondering who has achieved this level of Gnostic immortality. I mean, I guess Hermes and maybe Saint Germain, would you say those people have achieved?
Well, according to tradition, that's right. They even say Saint Germain still is in a human body. He's somewhere in the Far East. So many of the alchemists, Nicolas Flamel, that was a great French alchemist, supposedly he's still in a human body. They, at one point, there was some grave robbers to dug down and tried to rob his grave, but there was nothing in it. There was nothing in his casket. He wasn't there. You find that consistently in the stories of the alchemist that all of a sudden they're gone and there's nothing in the casket and there's no trace of them.
So you're practicing this alchemical science as well as part of the Gnostic understanding, huh?
Well, they're two sides of the same coin. It's through alchemy that we open up the Gnostic centers. It's through alchemy that we evolve ourselves, and that's what human evolution is about, is to evolve yourself to a certain frequency that you can know who and what you truly are, But it takes the alchemy to be totally immersed in that understanding, in that continual revelation.
Well, dude, going back to the Da Vinci Code, because you mentioned it early, do you think Da Vinci himself had some understanding? Because, the last painting he ever did was of John the Baptist, where one finger was pointing to the heart and the other finger was pointing to the sky.
And that's actually how Baphomet is depicted. One finger or hand pointing below and one above, because Baphomet is the union of heaven and earth, just like John the Baptist was. But Leonardo da Vinci, there seems to have been a split-off organization from the Templars, and some are calling it the Prior of Sion, which it could very well be. Actually, Sion is actually the Welsh name for John himself. Organization, there was also the lineage of John's, and it said that Leonardo da Vinci was John number 13 of that lineage. And so we had this huge obsession with John because John the Baptist was the founder of the whole Gnostic tradition, you know, in the West.
And this is not a celibate tradition. Do you think Jesus then and Mary Magdalene were a couple? They had children. They were practicers of this internal alchemy. Is that, do you go along with that?
No, you don't have to be celibate. That's one path, but it's certainly not the only path. And this day and age, it's not a path that's really works very well for most people. You know, and in the ancient times, in India, some of the earliest enlightened Gnostics were called the Rishis, and they had families, you know, they had wives and families. So, you know, it's always been part of the goddess tradition that there's, you could either become a celibate or you could be a householder, and, either one's equally fine, you know, and both lead to gnosis.
Well, you know, I know there's so much to cover, but there is something about the Lucifer connection with the goddess, at least in your book, that seems a little confusing. Can you just go over that?
Well, Lucifer is, if you study the ancient traditions, they all talk about, twins, the twin boys in all different traditions. And the twin boys came and brought the mysteries, and they shared them with their corresponding civilizations. The twin boys represent the goddess's power of creation and destruction. It's in Native America they're represented by the evening and morning setting of Venus. You know, the morning and evening stars, and Venus was the goddess herself. Well, the holder of the destructive power was the Lucifer, all right. And the holder of the creative power became the Christ. And so you had this legend of the Christ and the Satan, the Christ and Lucifer from way, way back. You know, it's
like Osiris and Seth. Yeah.
It didn't start with Christians. It goes way, way back. But you see, in the East, they had a different approach, a different perspective about Lucifer, and the powers of destruction, because they come from the goddess tradition, and it's all the goddess. And so how can you say that, you know, the creative power of the goddess is good and her destructive power is bad? I mean, it's all the goddess. If you're a real worshiper of the goddess, you love both. And you know that both are necessary in the cycle of creation and destruction, the early cycle, all cycles. Life leads to death, death leads to life. But you see, the yogis and the Gnostics of the East, they worship the destructive aspect of the goddess, the Luciferian structure, aspect of the goddess, because they know that it's that destructive energy that destroys everything that keeps them from knowing their divine nature. You know, and this is why the Kundalini itself is represented as Kali with her dripping fangs and her necklace of skulls, because she, as Kali, the Kundalini is Kali. When it wakes up, it destroys everything that keeps you from knowing your divine nature. All your limited concepts of reality, your ego, all the toxins that have accumulated in your various bodies. You see, so this is why every day all the Gnostics and the yogis in India, they give great worship to Kali and Shiva, the lords and ladies of destruction. You see, so they have a different understanding. But here in the West, which is basically based on a patriarchal ideology, we don't like the lords of destruction. We want to create our technology so that things won't change, so there'll be no destruction. So we have never liked the lords of destruction, you see. We like to keep it in the status quo.
Although we're the biggest destroyers there are in the West, you know, ultimately, really. I guess that's because we suppress the dark side. So it comes out unconsciously in war, in environmental destruction, in a disregard for the goddess. That's just how, when we suppress the dark side, it emerges in unconscious ways.
Right. And that's what we've been doing for ages, is suppressing it.
So where are we going? I mean, okay, so as these goddess emerges, as hopefully your understanding emerges, what are the new symbols for a new time? And is 2012 mean anything to you? So, but just give me what are the new symbols as we emerge into a new time with these new ideas?
Well, I believe that we're moving into the time of the one world civilization, and that's where all people feel connected and interconnected. That we're all part of the planetary family. There's the gradual dissolution of national boundaries and races. We all feel like we are one people. And according to if you look from the Freemasonry and secret society's perspective, it was actually the influence of the Syrians long ago that they've actually been behind the secret societies since the time of Lemuria, and that has been their goal, is to create that one world civilization, one world consciousness, one world spirituality. And this is why the Hopis today say that the new world, the new age is really going to start when there is the sighting of the blue star Kachina, and that is Sirius. That will reveal itself in this incredible dark blue ball of light. And so
will that be a spaceship from Sirius?
No, or? It's going to be the star itself. I mean, you look at some of the pictures of Sirius, it does kind of have a blue tone to itself occasionally.
Right, so the star's already out there, so it'll become more blue, the star, is that
exactly,
it?
Exactly, right. You know, there'll be no question when the vision appears, it'll be this incredible radiant blue energy that will just, I guess, just really fill up the heavens. It's supposed to be amazing according to the
will that be like a sort of
snow.
Supernova in a way?
Well, it could be, but they definitely say we will know for sure when it happens. There'll be no question.
Could that be the 2012 date that everybody's talking about?
It could very well be. Well, 2012 is a time when December 21st is when our sun is exactly conjunct the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Right.
And so that's why they're looking at it. So that basically the astrology chart for the new era will be at that day and time, and in that astrology chart, our sun is exactly conjunct with the center of the galaxy.
Well,
basically saying, so the whole new era, we are going to be totally in tune with the center of the galaxy.
Well, the center of the galaxy is the womb of creation, according to the Mayans. That center,
exactly.
That dark hole, that black hole at the center is the womb, so there's some energetic infusion that happens, I think will happen when we do line up, you know, exactly. When things are conjunct exactly, they have a different energy than almost conjunct. There's a kind
Absolutely.
Of like coming right online, not almost online. So I expect major events in a good way. I expect a positive thing to happen on December 21st, 2012. Because of the goddess energies and because of the nature of consciousness as we're opening up to these higher realms, which is what your work is about. It's the alchemical transformation of the self into becoming more divine-like.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to be a very significant time period. And one thing that we're going to do in our organization, it's in the planning stages now, but we're going to have a world conference to unite the religions on Sri Lanka. So Sri Lanka, according to the whole Muslim world, is the original Garden of Eden, even to the Mandeans and some of the other Gnostic sects. If you go to Sri Lanka today and climb up Adam's Peak, you find this huge footprint, and they say this is where God set Adam in the Garden of Eden. And so we're going to have a big conference here to unite the religions, because Sri Lanka, the Garden of Eden, is when they were all one, when they were all part of this Gnostic alchemical tradition, this pure primal spiritual tradition, and we're going to take them back there, and we're going to start the whole new era as one again, one people.
And when are you doing that?
Garden of Eden.
When is that conference happening?
December 21st, 2012.
Oh, that's where you're going to be, like bringing in the new era on Sri Lanka.
Exactly.
I'll make note of that because I'm trying to do an overview of where everyone will be on December 21st, 2012, just to kind of map it around the planet.
Okay, well, consider yourself invited.
Well, I'd love to. Is there anything like you'd like to leave us with in preparation for this coming workshop and weekend that you're doing here in New York?
Well, basically, what I'm trying to do is rally together, mobilize the people on the planet that are really ready to move into the next step, the next level, the Gnostic alchemical path, to bring back the primal religion, to work toward dissolving all the the boundaries and dogmas that have been separating us for the last 2,000 years. And I know they're out there, and they're ready to open up to their Gnostic awareness within themselves, but they're also ready to spread that Gnostic alchemical path around the world as great service. And so these are the kind of people that I really want to attract. And I know that a lot of them are out there, and they've been waiting for the time when they can come together with like-minded people in order to do this work. And I think that, well, I'm going to be attracting a lot of those this coming weekend.
Well, thank you so much. What's your website, and how can people get in touch with you?
It's www.gnostictemplars.org, and if you go on there, you can know all about us. You've got me speaking on all different topics, and there's all kinds of documents you can read, and you get a pretty good idea what we're all about, for sure.
Well, thank you, Mark. I look forward to meeting you and continuing this conversation on television, even.
Yeah, me too, Alan. Thank you very much. It's been great talking to you tonight.
Yeah, it's a nice introduction, I think, to the audience of the real message behind the Templars. So thanks for all your work.
Okay, well, thank you, Alan.
Okay, and this is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And check out my website, where I'll be posting this interview with Mark Amaru Pinkham, and talking about the workshops that are coming up. So that's newrealities.com. Thank you for listening.